Welcome to New Books in Journalism. I'm Dave Schwartz with the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And in this episode, we are talking with Eric Simons, the author of a book that I have just been dying to get my hands on and have been so ready to talk to the author about. The book is The Secret Lives of Sports Fans, The Science of Sports Obsession. It is a great read, and we hope that you enjoy the interview. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
So before we get into the book too much, and it's a fun book, tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and some of your past work.
Yeah, sure. So I'm actually a science writer, not very much a sports writer at all. I come into this as a journalist, and in the past, I've written a lot about, you know, kind of nature and the environment. And I actually wrote a book about Charles Darwin in South America and traveled around in South America. And so sports is something new for me to be writing about, although science, not so much. But part of the reason I came into this book is because I had almost these two parts of myself where I had the quiet little nature and science writer who, you know, kind of like to sit and read quietly and valued reason and calm. And then I had the raging sports fan inside of me that I have grown up with and been a sports fan all my life of my kind of Northern California teams. And this thing was, you know, clawing its way out to demand and like blood and vengeance and revenge. And somewhere in there, at some point, I realized that the two of these were oddly incompatible, but maybe I could make them compatible. Maybe I could force some reconciliation between my sports fan nature and my nature writing nature. And so out of that, I became a pop psychology writer.
It reminded me a bit of Malcolm Gladwell in a way about how he, you know, he embraces, he's very much a science and culture, and every now and then, you know, out comes the sports fan.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, when you start looking at sports, actually, there's it's this just terrific window into actually a lot of human behavior. And in some ways, it's kind of a safe space to look at a lot of the ways that we behave without, the emotional tension of trying to look at politics or conflict or war or any of that stuff. I mean, sports is just kind of sports. And I actually take it almost more seriously after writing this book in some ways, but it's still a kind of place where you can go and see humans on display doing all the silly things that humans do. And it's fun to learn about. I mean, it's a neat place to explore.
Sure. I mean, you know, the social and the emotional stakes are so high, but the pragmatic stakes are so low.
Yeah, exactly.
So take us, if you don't mind, take us where this book came from. And there's an incident you describe at the beginning of Cal football, one of your loves, against Oregon State. Tell us, you know, sort of the impetus for this book and where it came from.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really the inciting incident. And this is one of those things. I've been going to Cal football games since I was 4 months old. I mean, this is a tradition as deeply as any tradition that I know. My dad went to Cal, and so he hauled me. He's been a season ticket holder my entire life. He hauled me out when I was 4 months old. I've just always been there. I've grown up. The stadium's about as familiar as anything. We have our specific game ritual. And, they were really bad for most of my young adult life into kind of my late 20s. And then suddenly they got a new coach in the early 2000s. And I remember like really distinctly, I was traveling at the time and randomly clicked on ESPN one day, and they had like Cal ranked in the preseason top 25. And it was just like, wow, whoa. What? And so, you know, I just grew up with this team, and they were, you know, they're so much this part of my person. And then they became good. And it was this crazy, like, they've never been good. And just people like embraced this, and the stadium started filling up, and it just became so exciting. And the peak of this is in 2007. They start out, I think they're like 6-0 at the time, and they're a really good team. I mean, there's great players on this team. A lot of guys in the NFL now. DeSean Jackson, I think, is on this team, and they're ranked number 2 in the country. And it's a home game against Oregon State, who's unranked. And, you know, it's just one of those, like, this is manifest destiny sort of things. And then Louisiana Tech, who's ranked, or Louisiana State, excuse me, who is ranked number 1. Loses earlier in the day, and we're all in the stadium. It's kind of an evening game, and Cal goes down early. And then mounts this comeback, and they have the quarterback gets hurt, and the freshman quarterback that everybody's kind of wondering about comes in, and he plays great, and it's so awesome. And there's just this inspired comeback, and you can feel it in the stadium. Like, everybody is just like crackling with energy, and they're all the way coming back, and they get the ball down three at their own 10-yard line, and the freshman quarterback just throw after throw. It's beautiful, and they drive all the way down the field to the 10-yard line, and you like – we're going to do it. You just, you know, your brains are all sitting there like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're going to win this game. We're going to come all the way back and we're going to win this game. And we're going to be the number one team in the country. And but nobody even knows what that's like. Like, we haven't won. We haven't gone to the Rose Bowl since the 1950s. We haven't won the Rose Bowl since the 1930s. Like, nobody has any idea what we're going to do, except that the lid is going to blow off of this building. And they have first and 10 with like 8 seconds left and no timeouts. And they call a play, you know, it's one of those like, oh, he'll just, you know, there's no play open. He'll just throw it away. We'll kick a field goal. We'll tie it, but we'll go overtime. You know, we'll win this overtime. We're at home. We're ranked. We're a better team. We've got the comeback. And so the quarterback drops back to pass and he looks around and there's no one open. And we can all kind of see that no one's open. And actually the place we sit in the stadium, we're about 50 rows up, but right over this end zone. So we're looking down at this and you can see, okay, no one's open. So throw it away, Kevin, throw it away. And then you can start to feel this like Freudian, like, or this young, like collective unconscious, like everybody in the stadium was like bubbling up from the foundation, like throw it away, Kevin, throw it away, Kevin. And he doesn't throw it away and he starts running and you can see like instantly, like everybody's like hands are going to their head. Oh no, 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 no. And he starts to run and he's past the line of scrimmage and you can just see the Oregon State defenders. And there's like this moment of horror that I will never, ever forget, because then all of a sudden my hands are on my head and I'm looking and it's like, what's going on? No. And he gets tackled at the 3-yard line and you can remember like him thrashing forward and not making it. And that the clock runs out and they lose by 3. And the coach winds up and just slams his headset into the ground. Usually a pretty calm guy. And I remember we're all just standing there in the stands, like hands on our heads, like my mouth is agape. I don't like that descriptor because it's so often not true. You know, it's an exaggeration, but like really, I mean, my jaw has dropped and everybody around me, there's 70,000 people and we're all standing there just open mouth, like stunned, utterly stunned. And then, you know, we file out eventually and I had taken the train over from San Francisco where I live. And so I remember riding the train back and the game ended, I think around, 8 or 9 PM or something, which is perfect time. Everybody's going into the city on the train and they're all dressed up and, you know, they're going to nice dinners. And like, I love going out to dinner in San Francisco. It's a great food town. And, you know, there's these exciting new restaurants and there's theater. And like, I'm just thinking I'm riding this train in and here's all these people who are so excited and about all these, you know, nice things they're going to do in their lives with the theater and the movies and the big lights and the great food and, you know, classy cocktails. And I'm like crammed in the corner of the train and I smell bad because I've been sweating for the last 6 hours. And for dinner, I had like, you know, some horrible stadium hot dog. And I just had this like, well, what is wrong with me? I have this headache that I get when I wear my Cal hat for too long. Like, I need to get a bigger hat, but this is my hat. This is what I wear. And it's a little too small now because it's shrunk from sweat over so many Cal games. So it's like squeezing my head and just somewhere in there is the revelation that says, what are you doing? What is wrong with you? And I wish that this was the only time I'd ever been miserable like this, but I think if you're a sports fan, you ask yourself sometimes just in these moments, what is wrong with me? Why am I doing this? And then it occurred to me like, wait a minute, I write about science. I see all these books about, you know, neuroscience and the new brain science of this and the new brain science of that. Surely I can look into this and maybe figure this out. So I kind of saved up the memory and a few other painful, horrible memories of terrible moments in my sports fan life, and then kind of started to sit down and think about it, and started to call people and ask them about it, and what I came up with is kind of this book.
It's fascinating how it's set up into the three parts: the reflex and control and consequence. And I'm wondering why that way. How did you decide to structure the book the way you did?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something obviously I thought a lot about it, and took me a long time to get there. And I think this is because you know, I kind of hoped originally, you know, that this would be like a magazine article or something. I'd call up a researcher at Harvard and he would say, well, here's your answer right here. You know, it's this particular part of the brain. And it'd be like, great. And I'd write 1,000 words and I'd be done with it. And instead, what I found when I started looking at this is not only that sports fans are really complicated, but that if you want to explain them, you have to do a lot of work in a lot of different scientific fields. And you know, as a sports fan, I guess you know this. You know, your hormones are going crazy, and your brain is going crazy, and your memory and your emotions, and but also you're thinking a lot. There's, you know, if you're a baseball fan, there's all the math and statistics involved, and you know, football fans are calculating all these, you know, physics and speed and open spaces, and you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in your brain. And so I kind of started talking to people, and then I realized, well, there's kind of a separate thing. There's stuff that happens to you when you're watching sports, and just you can't do anything about it. This is just if you are a human being watching other human beings compete, watching other human beings in action, there are just things that happen to your brain, things that happen to your body. But one of the defining things about sports fans is that we have these reflexes, but then we filter them so much through our emotions, through our experiences, through our memory. And that's what creates so much of the kind of complexity of sports fans, is not just that we have these reflexes, but that we so often and so cleverly find ways to ignore them. and then what happens, of course, is that you take all this stuff, and because we're so good at manipulating what should be straightforward reflex, we have a lot of societal kind of consequence. It changes the way we behave as individuals and as groups, and not always in good ways. Although I, as a lifelong sports fan, tend to think that, you know, on the whole, sports is not the worst thing you could be doing. But certainly you can look at a lot of examples of sports fans behaving pretty badly. So I kind of built the book in this, well, here's just the most basic explanation I can give for what happens to you. And then here's how we actually take what happens to us, and we, you know, often on an unconscious level still, we control it or we manipulate it. And then here's kind of what that means for the way we behave when you put us in a big group with a lot of other people who aren't necessarily sports fans.
There's, you know, as sports fans, we're watching people who don't know us do things of little overall consequence, and yet we get so worked up and use this term of the physical experience of fandom. How does being a fan take a physical toll on us?
Yeah, this is really interesting, actually, because again, like you say, we don't know these people. We're not participating. But it turns out, you know, the reason for this we could go into later, it's complicated, but it turns out that people watching other people compete have a lot of hormonal reactions as if they were competing themselves. And they've kind of built this case over the last 20 years or so. They've known for longer than that if you are in a direct competition with someone, if you're fighting them, you're boxing them, even if you're, you know, playing chess against them, playing tennis against them, you know, sort of less belligerent sports, you have a pretty predictable testosterone response in particular, but all your kind of hormones that you have that control a little bit the way you feel, the way you act. You know, you have a stress hormone that makes you feel stressed out, and you actually have a love hormone, sort of oxytocin, that makes you feel a little bit more trusting, a little bit more loving, a little bit more cooperative. That's active when you're watching sports. You have adrenaline, of course, but the big one I think in sports fans is testosterone. And we have known for a long time that in people directly competing, testosterone changes. It goes up when you're challenged, when you think you're going to be in a fight. It seems to go up again when you win a fight. They argue that there's an evolutionary explanation for this, which is that if you have won a fight, you know, whether you're a bird or a monkey or a human, there's some evolutionary benefit to consolidating your victory and going on and beating up other people right after you've won. and if you've lost a fight, it's better to go off and heal and recover than it is to just keep stupidly fighting. So you basically see in winners, you see their testosterone continue to go up, and in losers, you see their testosterone go down. And it all makes sense that this changes, because it also makes sense. You wouldn't want to just go around the world being belligerent and picking fights all the time. You want it to be able to respond to the situation you're in. So what you see in people who are playing a sport is this change. And then they had this question, well, is this really what happens in just people watching? And yeah, it is. From a very small study of the 1994 World Cup, where they found that the victorious Brazilian fans watching on television from Atlanta, finals in Pasadena, which is 3,000 miles away, the victorious fans had a testosterone increase. The losing Italian fans had a testosterone decrease. They've kind of expanded that since. The big one in this actually is a researcher at Duke who thought about this and thought, well, it doesn't have to be sports for it to be a vicarious dominance competition, as they call it. You know, this is basically what an election is in our winner-take-all political cycle. So in the 2008 presidential election, he looked at the hormones of voters, looked at people who had voted for Barack Obama and who'd voted for John McCain and the Libertarian candidate Bob Barr, and basically found the same thing, that the testosterone of Obama voters went up after the decision was announced, and the testosterone of McCain and Barr voters went down after the winner had been declared, and kept going down for about 40 minutes afterwards, which is the period over which he measured. And so there's this response: your testosterone is changing. Just based on whether they win or lose when you're watching. But there's a couple of complicating things there, which I haven't mentioned yet. One is only if you're a man, it appears, or most likely only if you're a man. In this election study, women showed nothing at all. In a lot of studies, women don't show quite the reaction, and they're not quite sure why, which is very interesting. Women in direct competition sometimes show this and sometimes don't. And so one theory is just that, well, it's a lower baseline in women. It's a little harder to measure a testosterone response in them or a big change in them. Another theory is, in men, the testosterone is made in the testes, which have the ability to kind of pump out a lot really quickly. Women, testosterone is made in the ovaries and in the adrenal glands. It doesn't happen as quickly. So they may have a testosterone response to something like this, but you don't measure it quite as fast. You don't see it 20 minutes after an election like you do in men. But either way, there's kind of this interesting gender imbalance in how your hormones respond. The other interesting thing here is that none of this actually happens at all if you don't care. If you're just a neutral person watching this election, your testosterone doesn't change because you don't care. And so it's this reminder that, well, you have this unconscious reflex, and you know all the legend of testosterone. It makes you aggressive and belligerent and all this stuff. But so it's like it robs you of your free will while you're watching sports. You're just sitting there minding your own business on the couch, and your team wins a game, and your testosterone goes up. It's like, that's not fair. But it's also only because you care. And so this is kind of where, you get into this idea of reflex and then how we control our reflex, because it turns out that with testosterone, especially, there's a lot of stuff that goes into how big the response is, how much you care, how much you think you participated in the outcome, even in people like on a soccer team who are competing directly. If you scored the winning goal, you have a higher testosterone increase when you win than somebody who feels like I just sat the bench. And so in fans, this is true a little bit as well. The more invested you are, the bigger your response. The more emotional the game is, the bigger the response. And it turns out there's a lot of ways we have developed to kind of control this testosterone reflex, which is pretty interesting.
It almost sounds as if testosterone is some sort of a physiological currency.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, you have little bits of it, and you can use them, you can expend them to kind of gain a temporary boost, and it really raises your awareness, your situational awareness, and your power, and promotes muscle growth and this sort of stuff. And you can kind of spend it at that time to become more aggressive and go on and win something. Unfortunately, as a sports fan, You can't make your team win anymore once they've already won. But you can use it, and if you lose it a little bit, it's better to not just keep gambling away your testosterone. It's better to go back and recoup your losses some other time.
It's interesting. As I was reading through the part one, I was thinking, I grew up in St. Louis, and so I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan, and they won the World Series in '82, and then not again until 2000. 6. And I remember, you know, being so geared up during that World Series, and they won. The final out is made, and they win. And Adam Wainwright, you know, strikes the guy out to end the game. And instead of getting higher, I almost felt almost like some like numb. But it was like I had plateaued on some level. Like, that's it. I've achieved this.
Yeah.
As if I was somehow on the field with them.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's a couple of ways of thinking about that as well. I mean, one of them, the other big reflex that I haven't really talked about is kind of what's happening in your brain, which is the way you see the world, which allows you a very deep empathy with the players, with other people in action. And, you know, I can describe this mirror neuron system that they call it in your head, which is what they think is there's these neurons, you know, when you do an action, you have a set of neurons that tells your muscles, okay, here's what we're going to do. You basically have planning neurons, and the neurons that then say specifically, okay, you know, arm muscle, do this. And what they noticed about 15 or 20 years ago is that, well, it seems like these planning neurons turn on whether you're doing the action or just watching someone do the action. In fact, it seems like they do it whether you're just hearing about it. So if you say, hit the baseball, you know, all the neurons that would plan and execute the action of you hitting a baseball light up. And the more you do something, it seems, the more active those are. They actually test, they have this great test of basketball players, and they're looking at elite basketball players and just people who watch a lot of basketball, coaches and sports journalists, and then people who don't ever play. And they measure not only their brain activity, but the muscle like twitches in their hands and forearms. And they find the elite players basically have more activity in their hands when there's these little tremors. They call them corticospinal activations. You know, they're getting ready. When they see somebody shooting a basketball, they're getting ready to go do a rebound in a way that people who don't watch basketball aren't. And so the argument is you have this really, really deep empathy with other people, and especially people who are doing an action that you've watched a lot or that you've played a lot. And especially people who you apply a lot of filters to, especially people who are in something that you perceive as a friendly group, people that you identify with, you know, there's all these kind of ways that you can deepen this empathy response so that you really are running this like full scale simulation as if it's you out there. And so when they win the World Series, like number one, yeah, you do feel like you're on the field because your brain is kind of running around like you are. And then there's a lot of emotional stuff you apply on top of that that'll really make this feel even more real to you. So it's a pretty great and complicated description of euphoria, I guess.
I guess the other side of that euphoria would be, and I hate to pick on the poor city, but you've got a great chapter on Cleveland.
Yeah.
and sort of this identity that goes with people who identify with teams from Cleveland. And of course, yeah, they haven't won a title, I don't know, in 50 plus years or however long it's been in any sport.
It's been a while. And they know exactly when it was, which is one thing I love about Cleveland. I think Cleveland has two big points, though. One of which is that you ask, I mean, they're kind of the perfect study for, well, if you know that you're getting jerked around by your testosterone and you know that you're behaving badly because of sports, that sports has a lot of negatives. And then you see a team that never, ever wins, that for 50 years has found creative and terrible ways to lose. Why do you keep coming back? And this was kind of the question that I went to Cleveland trying to get people to answer. Is like, why are you still here? Because, well, you know, what's the meaning of this? And the answer, there's two of them, and I like both of these a lot. One of them is that this is a really important source of identity for people, that you know, this is a world that can be quite complicated. You can fall in and out of love. You can lose your job. You can move. You can lose your house. You can leave a city. But it's very hard. Of course, in Cleveland, this is not true. But it's very hard for somebody to take a sports team away from you. And so, it's very important to us to be able to say who we are quickly. To be, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm a husband. I'm a father. But, you know, one of the safest ways you can say is I'm a Cleveland fan. And So in some ways, the sports teams are really protecting this identity of Cleveland and of Clevelanders and giving them this kind of foundation to work off in the rest of their lives. No matter what else happens to you, it's very hard for somebody to take "I'm a Cleveland fan" away from you. And you look at something like when Art Modell did take the Browns away from the city, the reaction, which was just kind of anguished, but also angry, because he was really ripping a part of people out of the city. And then you look at also what the city did. Well, I mean, they sued and said, you can take the players, you can take the coach, but you can't take the colors because those are ours. And, you know, if you're going to be a Cleveland fan, you're going to be a fan of the brown and orange. And that's who we are, which is really interesting. And I think this kind of, it leads into the second part of this, which is, you know, there's these people who study relationships and there's a guy who was at the University of Stony Brook, New York, and now is State University of New York, Stony Brook, and now is at UC Berkeley. And he had this question about loving couples, where he wanted to look in their brains and see, you know, what brain structures would be active when you look at a person who's been happily married for 20 years in the scanner, and they look at a picture of their significant other. He was kind of curious because we know that sexual desire has its own brain structure. And he was curious, does love have its own brain structure? And so he looks in there, and what he finds instead is that love seems to be activating this kind of general reward pathway that we have, that you see basically a pretty similar activation in people who think they're going to win a lot of money, in people who are looking at sports cars, in people who are taking cocaine. We have kind of a very basic architecture in our brain for it's really actually not basic at all. It's very complicated, but on a broad level, it's pretty basic. This reward pathway called a dopamine reward system, and you get dopamine surprisingly not so much for in a sports context, not so much maybe for winning and losing, although you get it for that too. But one of the things you get it for is the lasting endurance of the relationship, like a loving couple. You know, it's the relationship, it's the connection that matters as much as any individual moment in there. And so I think you look at people in Cleveland, and it actually makes it kind of almost a sweet and a happy story that the value they get is not necessarily in the winning and losing, although it would be a very big reward if they won. But a lot of the reward in sports and a lot of the reasons we stick with this has to do because of the value of the relationship itself. And so it's so important to you to have this team, to be doing this, that your brain actually gets a reward from that, just from being a fan. You are rewarded as if, you know, as you would be just by being married.
But by and large, to follow up with Cleveland a bit, when you were there and doing your research and talking to people, how open were people from Cleveland to talk about their, I don't know if misery is the right word, but just their loyalty, I guess. How open were they to you?
They love it. I think actually that Cleveland sports fans are very proud of their and I talk about about pride and the evolutionary origins of pride based on a work of a psychologist at the University of New South Wales in Australia. But people love it. They love outsiders coming in and asking, you know, tell me about your history as a Cleveland sports fan. You know, everybody I asked, I was walking up to random people on the street, and they just, I mean, it's hilarious. They're leaning over and pointing in my notebook and, you know, saying, write this down. We're the most miserable people. And I'd ask, well, you know, what about the Cubs? Oh, don't bring that weak stuff here. The Cubs, get out of here. Yeah. Well, what about Seattle? What about Sandy? Oh, come on. Nothing like us. And he was like, you'd ask him about Seattle, which is like not exactly a happy sports city, especially lately. And they're like, oh, the Supersonics won the NBA title in the 1970s. And nothing like us. And it's like, wow, they have like, they're not only extremely aware of all the ways that the Cleveland teams have failed them over the years, they're super aware of all the other ways that like anybody who could compete with them being the most tortured sports city is disqualified. yeah, you know, Cubs fans, they secretly enjoy it. It's a social thing, not like it, they care about losing. Seattle, they won the NBA title. San Diego's got nice weather. Like, eh.
What do you think would happen to the identity of a Cleveland sports fan if they won, if the Cavs or if the Browns won, you know, a title? What would happen?
Yeah, I think this is such a terrific question. And in the book, I kind of talked about, well, I think there's a psychological process where, you know, the pride thing that I talked about is the way the researcher looks at this is kind of this. It's not necessarily like a boastful thing. She doesn't look at it quite as a negative as I think we kind of use it in a vernacular sense. She's looking at it more pride as, you know, knowing that you did a good job and knowing that other people know you did a good job. And then they have self-esteem, which is just kind of this, you know, I know I did a good job and I feel great about it. And I think part of what happens when they win is they just have this tremendous amount of pride, and it's all converted into self-esteem. Like, you really feel good about yourself. And part of the euphoria is, you know, recognizing that everybody else in the world now sees that you have done something well. The other thing that I think happens is there's a bit of an identity crisis. And like, I looked at, there's a famous English example of this in the Manchester City soccer team, which was like the lovable losers of the English Premier League for 45 or 50 years or something. And they had, you know, the fan base had this terrific response, you know, where they'd really developed their own culture of losing and enjoyed the losing part of this. And then all of a sudden, I think in 2008, they get bought out by, you know, kind of a wealthy Middle Eastern conglomerate, and they spend a ton of money and they turn them into a really, really good team. And a few years later, they win the English Premier League. And all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, well, who are we now? what do we do next? And it's like Boston. It's the same thing in Boston. I think, you know, you saw Boston fans, you know, of course they tremendously enjoyed it. I mean, it was just a, you know, moving and incredibly emotional and meaningful thing for the Red Sox to win the World Series. And then for a year or two following that, there was this weird, like, what are we now? And, you know, there's like fan infighting. You see like Bill Simmons arguing with people and, you know, the pink hats, the pink Boston hats, and everybody arguing with, you know, should Jimmy Fallon have been on the field, and does that cheapen their World Series win, and all this stuff where, you know, there's this real like argument all of a sudden about who's a real Boston fan. And I think you would see the same thing in Cleveland. I think you would see, you know, an incredible citywide euphoria for months after the win, no matter what, you know, whether it's in baseball or basketball or football. I think you would just see the city go crazy. And then there would settle in this like the recrimination period, like, well, who are we now? And then they would have this argument, and they would have to sort out who they are now. And, you know, like, I think Boston has kind of adopted now, like, they're a front runner town. Like, now they're not the lovable losers anymore. Now they're the guys who everybody expects to win. They're the bullies. So you know, it would be hilarious to watch that happen in Cleveland. And they'd have to sort it out for themselves.
I remember seeing that in Chicago in 2005 when the White Sox won the World Series.
Definitely.
And it was like this South Side, North Side. The one thing that unified them is they were both losers. And then, and then the White Sox went and won. And the urban legend was that Jerry Reinsdorf had once said that he would trade all six Bulls titles for one World Series win. And then he finally had it. And you could see this power dynamic shift in Chicago when they won, where all of a sudden the Cubs fans got a little quieter. You know, and the Sox fans, you know, stuck out their chest. And even now, as they're, you know, suffering through a miserable season, and the Cub fans say, "Ha, you're even worse than we are." They still go back to, "Yeah, but we won the World Series."
Well, I mean, it's been pretty interesting to be here in San Francisco. I'm not a Giants fan necessarily, but the city really went nuts. They've won two of the last three World Series, and people here have just gone crazy. And they hadn't won one in their entire time in San Francisco before that. And so it was interesting. I hadn't been really in a citywide euphoria like that, but I kind of live on the outside of the Mission District of the city, which is not necessarily what you'd think of as the big sports part of San Francisco. And nonetheless, it just went crazy. A million people showed up for the parade, and there was this just like triumphant, you know, weird feeling. And then, like, I grew up as an A's fan in the East Bay, and so there was a kind of a, you know, and clearly the A's, who were the dominant team through the 80s and kind of early 90s, suddenly, you know, the A's were, it became painfully apparent, drawing 10,000 or 8,000 people for a game, and the Giants were just the it thing. It was very interesting.
There's a, later on in the book, it's fascinating that you write about a researcher and a professor named Daniel Wan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's so much of his work has been influential on sports fans, but you did something interesting in which you turned him into a character, almost the subject,
yeah.
Instead of the researcher. Take some time to describe, you know, sort of who he is and what it is that you were learning from being around him or talking with him.
Yeah. So he's great. And the reason I turned him into a character is because I started calling people, you know, looking into this stuff, and then realized there aren't a lot of people who actually are looking at sports fans. And I found that pretty interesting. You know, from the testosterone guys who are looking at elections, and the mirror neuron people are, they're looking a little bit at sports fans, but may, you know, it's not their priority. They're looking, they think that this is the answer to autism, and, you know, they think that this explains serial killers have a deficit of mirror neuron function and empathy. And, you know, it has all these implications for the development of language. Like, why are they going to waste their time looking at sports fans? And so, you know, I kind of was going in circles for a while trying to find, well, who actually studies the sports fans? And it led me to this utterly fantastic guy at Murray State University in Kentucky named Daniel Wan. And I made sure he does a little conference every year with a friend of his who's also a sports fan researcher at Western Kentucky. And they have a little kind of symposium every year where they go over kind of what they're working on. And so I went out there and visited them, and they were just, they were terrific guys. And I turned them into characters in part because I enjoyed so much the way they go about looking into sports. And so Dan and I had these conversations, and he arrived in it the same way that I did. He's a big Royals fan, but he's also just, he has all the same, why am I doing this questions? And he set about over the last 20 years to kind of do his best to address all these questions. He doesn't have a big research lab. So a lot of it he's had to do pretty cleverly, just kind of as he can. But he's really got there, and he's asked all the questions in his own way. And so it was really fun to talk to him, and we went out to lunch and just kind of had this long talk. He's just a very funny guy. And so he'd have these terrific, I'd ask him these questions. Well, you know, people talk about this as an escape. I never feel like it's an escape for me because my teams all make me miserable, and I generally like the rest of my life. And he just like jumps in right away. He's like, it's because your teams suck. so he's a great guy. And I think the other neat thing that he did that really helped me was he kind of has done a lot of surveys and just kind of polls of people and has really narrowed down the why people do this to kind of 8 like reliable, here's why people say they are sports fans, which kind of illustrates the complexity of this. I mean, there's 8 that he's got sort of fundamental, like different ways we could all be watching this. But also as helpful as, just, okay, here are the kind of ways into this for people. And he's done work, you know, how do people get introduced to sports? Why do they say they go to sports? And he's kind of looked at, how do people, behave, what do they say about why they go to games live? And it gets almost crazy at times when he's doing studies. You know, they'll ask him to come up with a formula for predicting fan success or fan engagement or something. Says, well, okay, if you add this and this and this and this together, I guess you kind of get a little measure of fan engagement. So he's a fun guy to talk to, and he has just interesting work. And he has this backstory where he wanted to do work in social science. He got a PhD in psychology. And, as he was going around, trying to figure out what he was going to do his work in, he tells the story that everybody else seemed so miserable. He's like, man, I better pick something I'm interested in. And he was interested, as I am, in sports fans and why they behave the way they do. So.
Why do you think, and I'm going to ask you to speculate a bit, why do you think more work, more research hasn't been done on sports fans?
I think there's two reasons. One is that I think legitimately it's hard to get money for it. Right. If you're running, brain scanning technology is new enough that it's expensive still. And if you're applying to limited funders and limited time in the machines and you need a lot of money to run a brain scan study, it's hard to. If you're competing against all the really valuable things that are happening out there, and Dan and I talked about this too, it's hard to say, well, my study of why some Cubs fans cry and some don't needs priority over why do some people get cancer. you kind of understand there, but
good point.
but at the same time, I actually think there's a lot of valuable stuff. I was saying earlier, I think the cool thing about sports fans is this is actually a way to look at a lot of very basic human processes and the way we behave, not just in sports, because our behaviors in sports are not, it's not like we have a sports watching part of our brain. We just have a regular old human brain, and we're recruiting all these other things that we do in other places and using them in sports. And so, my opinion is that sports is actually a really valuable way to study human behavior, and human behavior in a lot of ways, it's easier to study sports fans. If you want to study tribalism and how people behave in groups, you could spend a lot of money, doing a year long ethnographic study of a tribe somewhere in Papua New Guinea, where you could just go look at Cubs and White Sox fans.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but you've got this about groups. You've got this great little passage in there. Yeah. About the post 2003 Super Bowl Raiders, in which that was sort of they peaked and then have hit this epically low valley in the team's history. Kind of explain what that was like.
Raiders fans. So Raiders fans are getting back to this little. They're a puzzling group, but I actually find them much nicer and more pleasant than their reputation. And I think a lot of this has do with the way we act as groups, and getting back to this idea that the brain reflects the way we act as sports fans reflects a lot of the ways we act as people, and Raiders fans are very, or at least the really hardcore ones, the Raider Nation are very tight with each other. This is a family to them, and one of the things that this kind of does, and the way our brains are set up to process groups, is this makes you favor people in your own group, and so they really, in a lot of ways, the Raider Nation is an interesting model because it is kind of all classes and races and genders. It really embraces them all. As long as you're wearing silver and black, like, you are a member of this family. But then they're so proud of the family and they're so into the family that a lot of times they misbehave to non-family members. So I have a couple of stories about the Raiders, than the Raider Nation in my book. The one I kind of like the most is a lot of the different characters in the Raider Nation and their kind of ups and downs over the last few years and how they got to be where they are. And this guy, Gorilla Rilla, who they describe as the beating heart of the Raider Nation, a guy who's dressed up for the last 18 years as a gorilla for all Raiders games, and is like the sweetest, nicest, kindest guy I've ever met. He's so, so nice. But he really is just all about his Raider family. He's all about kind of loving his friends and his family and his team. But then you go into the stands with these guys and the group is so tight knit that part of what it does is it responds to outsiders. There's some psychologists have different ideas about where in our past kind of our propensity for group conflict comes from. But one of the arguments is it's just, we're really good at identifying people in our own group and really good at applying all these biases, just unconsciously. We think better of ourselves and of the people we're close to than we do of outsiders. And the Raiders fans are like this living example of this. They're very bad at assessing the motivations of others and assuming hostile intent when none is intended. So they react react very defensively and very aggressively to anything they perceive as criticism, and they are quite sensitive.
And it's almost like they took on, it reminds me of you know, Peter Richman wrote the book Badasses.
Yeah.
It's almost like they took on the persona of this 1970s, you know, Raiders teams, but they never really quite let it go.
Yeah, that's a very, very strong and I think correct argument that you know, those teams were something similar, that they took on people who felt like they didn't fit in elsewhere, and responded aggressively to what they viewed as societal criticism, and how strong that societal criticism was, I'm not sure, but they certainly perceived it. You know, and this motivates all athletes. You know, Aaron Rodgers, who went to Cal and, you know, became the Green Bay Packers quarterback, is motivated by, you know, what he perceives as this giant slight of the universe, that nobody drafted him to go to a major college until Cal's coach picked him out of junior college, and that he dropped all the way to, you know, 24th in the first round or whatever. Like, well, you know, that still means you were in the first round. Like, it still means everybody thought you were pretty damn good. But, you know, people take slights against them and blow them up. But I think the Raiders do this. And you know, they had these players who felt miscast elsewhere, and so it would come here, and the fans adopted this, like, we don't fit in with the rest of society, so we got to be Raider Nation. And I think it's still true a little bit. Like, I think most of these people would fit in just fine, but perceive the world as hostile to them, in part because it gives value and meaning to their group. It makes you feel like a more proud member of the group when you view everyone else as against you. It keeps you cohesive.
Yeah, it's you're talking about how, you know, sports is sort of a safe place to study the broader questions of the human condition. And
yeah,
you can see that, you know, the themes that you touch on, you know, empathy and addiction and love and behavior and groups. And one of the last ones you mentioned is war.
Yeah.
And one of my backgrounds is in sport. I'm not doing it anymore, but it was in sports writing. And it was drilled into you over and over. You know, the deep pass is no longer called the bomb. And don't call them warriors. Yeah. Don't call them soldiers. But you made this conscious choice to invoke the word war.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, terrific question. Because of exactly what you said, because I'd read so much that talked about this as a war, because so many people, I mean, I had this great thing where I was sitting in San Francisco one night, and we're sitting in a bar somewhere, and it's one of these kind of fashionable bars where the tables are a little too close together, and I'm talking to a friend of mine, and we're talking about, you know, why do people watch sports? And this guy, like, butts in, just leans over from the other table and says, "Dude, it's a war metaphor, bro." And then he just, like, leans back, and it's like the, like, voice from above that says, "Okay, well, why is this a war metaphor? You know, it's competitive. So how much does this look like war?" And people, you know, dismissively say, "Oh, this is just tribalism. You know, this is little men pretending that they're having a battle, so they don't need to have a real battle." And so I tried to look at a lot of the ways you know, we do behave in war, and compare it and see, you know. If people talk about tribalism, well, how do tribes actually behave? Does it look like sports fans? And kind of look at how much sports really is a war by proxy. My argument in there is actually not as much as it has always been given credit for, and that you need to separate out the way humans fight with each other. You need to separate conflict from competition, and that, you know, unless you really look at war as something, you know, between nations as something involving a lot of complexity and different action, you know, it doesn't just involve conflict, it involves love and sacrifice and altruism and all this stuff. Well, okay, then maybe sports is more of a war metaphor because war is just the human condition. But, you know, in terms of just specifically, is this conflict, is this simulated conflict? I'm not so sure. I think it's much more accurate to say that this is competition. And that humans are very wired to like competition, but I'm not sure that we're wired for conflict.
So going back to the beginning, this, I'm sorry to bring up Cal Oregon State again.
All right. I've replayed it in my head a billion times.
That being the inspiration for the book, and you wondering, you know, why did you feel the way that you felt after that game? You know, and even years later, what did you learn about the subject? What did you learn about yourself through the process of this book?
Yeah, well, I think the great thing I learned from this is that it's not as silly as it often feels. And, you know, I think the moment there that was so distressing was not necessarily the moment where they lost the game. I mean, that was very painful. But the moment that was the worst was their train ride home, where I sat there and was like, I don't understand why I do this, and where I felt like I'm an idiot. This is dumb. This is irrational. And I think having spent a bunch of time kind of talking to these psychologists, it makes a lot more sense to me now why we do this and why we put up with the pain. And so, you know, I don't think it lessens my irritation or frustration or pain at all at the team performing poorly. But I think that I don't have to sit on the train anymore and feel ashamed and wonder why. And that's kind of my takeaway, is that actually sports is not, it is a silly little game in some ways, but it's silly in the way that, you know, most personal and important and meaningful family things are silly. My kids' school play doesn't really mean anything to the world at large, but it's important to me. And I think that's kind of how I've come to understand relationships with our sports teams is something that is important to us, and for good reasons, for, you know, pretty sound psychological reasons. This is meaningful to us. This is not something to be embarrassed about, and it's not silly. And so, I have saved myself the agonized train ride home, where I thrash around wondering why I'm such an idiot, and now I just thrash around wondering why my team sucks so bad.
So the work is done. The book is out. It's on bookshelves. Yeah. What's next for you?
Yeah. Well, actually, I've got a bit of a cool opportunity right now to do a bit more research, which we're kind of talking about. But I've talked to some of the researchers in the book, and I'm kind of coordinating a bit with them to do some more studies to kind of see if we can actually study sports fans in some of these areas and maybe learn a little bit more. I talk about love and what happens when you look at it, a person you've been married to for a long time, but, you know, maybe we'll get a chance now to look and see really what happens in your brain when you look at the sports team you've been married to for a long time. So I'm doing a little bit of that. And I'm kind of just back to, writing for magazines. I may just return to my quiet, happy little world of nature writing, where there are no, where I can once again separate my professional life from the agony of all my sports teams.
Well, the book is The Secret Lives of Sports Fans, The Science of Sports Obsession, and the author is Eric Simons. Eric, I've had a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, me too. That's terrific. Thank you so much for having me.
This has been New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find The Secret Lives of Sports Fans by Eric Simons at Amazon and other retailers. Thank you for listening.